strong. Good luck from VOA Wonder Hits.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Ashley Thompson.
And I'm Dan Novak. This program is designed for English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
On today's program, Katie Weaver and Gregory Stockel tell us about threats that several kinds of turtles worldwide are facing. Brian Lynn presents this week's science report. We close with the next episode of our U.S. history series. But first, here are Katie and Gregory.
A growing demand for turtles as pets in the United States, Asia, and Europe has led to a rise in poaching. Poaching means to catch or kill an animal illegally. Wildlife trade experts believe the rise in poaching is adding to the worldwide drop in rare freshwater turtles and tortoises. Such concerns have led to proposals to increase protection for freshwater turtles. More than 180 nations have gathered this week in Panama as part of the Convention on International Trade in Endangered Species of Wild Fauna and Flora, or CITES. The CITES meeting runs from November 14th to the 25th. Exact numbers on the turtle trade, especially illegal trade, can be hard to find. Tara Easter, a doctoral student at the University of Michigan, studies the trade. She looked at turtle trade data from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. She estimates that the business export trade for mud turtles in the United States increased from 1,844 in 1999 to nearly 40,000 in 2017. And she estimated that the trade in musk turtles increased from 8,254 in 1999 to more than 281,000 in 2016.
The Collaborative to Combat the Illegal Trade in Turtles is a group of mostly state, federal, and tribal biologists working to combat poaching of North American turtles. Since 2018, the group has documented at least 30 major illegal trafficking cases in 15 states. Some involved fewer than 50 turtles. Other cases involved several thousand turtles. Earlier this year, a federal judge in North Carolina sentenced a man to 18 months in prison and fined him $25,000 for trafficking turtles in violation of the Lacey Act. The law bans trafficking in fish, wildlife, or plants that are illegally taken, held, transported, or sold. The man trafficked 722 eastern box turtles, 122 spotted turtles, and 3 wood turtles for markets in Asia. The man received more than $120,000 for the turtles, which have a value of $1.5 million in Asia.
Freshwater turtles are among the world's most trafficked animals. They are targeted by criminal networks that connect with buyers on the internet. They transport the reptiles to black markets in Hong Kong and other places in Asia. From there, they are sold as pets to collectors and for breeding, food, and traditional medicine. In many countries, there are no laws to govern the trade. the business can be highly profitable. Some kinds of turtles are sought out for their colorful or unusual appearance. They can be sold for thousands of dollars in Asia. The trade adds to the threats turtles already face, including climate change, environment destruction, and other animals eating their eggs. Experts say poachers are even more problematic because they target rare kinds of turtles and adult females. The loss of large numbers of adults, especially females, can send turtles into a spiraling decline from which they cannot recover, said Dave Collins. He is director of North American Turtle Conservation for the Turtle Survival Alliance.
The United States and several Latin American countries have proposed banning or limiting the trade in more than 20 turtle species. In their CITES proposal, the countries included data from Mexico that found nearly 20,000 were confiscated from 2010 to 2022. To confiscate means to take something away from someone to enforce laws or rules. The illegal trade has also led governments to propose listing, for the first time, 42 turtle species under CITES, including North American musk turtles. A listing means traders will need permits to sell them internationally. Matthew Strickler is with the U.S. Department of the Interior. He is heading the American group at the CITES meeting in Panama. He called the possible listings and increased protection for North American turtles really, really important. We've seen this pattern of turtles being depleted in one place, and then poachers and traffickers and traders moving to another place, Strickler said. Southeast Asia was depleted. They moved to Africa. Now we see them moving to the Americas. I'm Katie Weaver.
And I'm Gregory Stockel.
Next up is this week's Science Report with Brian Lynn.
The American Space Agency, NASA, recently launched its powerful Space Launch System, or SLS, rocket and Orion spacecraft on a test mission to fly around the moon. The launch marked the first flight for SLS, which NASA describes as the most powerful rocket ever built. The project has faced years of delays and is running billions of dollars over budget. Now that the rocket has launched and successfully deployed its spacecraft, we are taking a closer look at the mission NASA says is the first step in returning astronauts to the moon. The SLS mission is part of NASA's Artemis program, which aims to land Americans on the moon by the mid-2020s. It would be the first moon landing by astronauts since NASA's Apollo 17 mission in 1972. The next crew to land on the moon is expected to include the first woman and the first person of color. The goal of the latest uncrewed test mission is to prepare for Artemis II, which will include astronauts traveling inside the Orion spacecraft, or capsule. If all goes well during those missions, NASA will launch Artemis III with the goal of landing astronauts on the moon's surface. the Orion capsule is expected to complete a 25-day flight that will bring it to within 97 kilometers of the lunar surface. It will travel 64,000 kilometers beyond the Moon before heading back to Earth. NASA is testing the effects of the trip on three mannequins built as models for real human astronauts. They are connected to a series of sensors designed to measure radiation and movements throughout the mission. At 98 meters, SLS is shorter and thinner than the Saturn V rockets that carried 24 Apollo astronauts to the Moon in the 1960s and 1970s. But the new Moon rocket is much more powerful, with 4 million kilograms of thrust. NASA's high-tech self-flying Orion capsule is named after the Orion constellation, which can be seen around the world and is among the brightest in the sky. At 3 meters tall, Orion is roomier than Apollo's capsule and seats 4 astronauts instead of 3. Unlike the SLS rocket, Orion has launched before. It circled Earth twice in 2014. Orion is carrying a series of equipment known as payloads to support science experiments. Among the payloads are 10 CubeSats. These are small research spacecraft, also called nanosatellites. One of the CubeSats is designed specifically to look for and examine lunar ice while Orion orbits the Moon. Others will collect other lunar data in an effort to provide scientists with more detailed information on the materials the Moon is made of. More than 50 years later, Apollo still stands as one of NASA's greatest achievements. Using 1960s technology, NASA took just 8 years to go from launching its first astronaut, Alan Shepard, to landing Neil Armstrong and Edwin Buzz Aldrin on the Moon. By comparison, Artemis has already been in development for more than 10 years. While 12 Apollo astronauts walked on the Moon from 1969 through 1972, none stayed on the lunar surface for longer than 3 days at a time. For Artemis, NASA will draw from a more diverse pool of astronauts. The agency is also expanding the time crews spend on the Moon to at least a week. The Artemis program also calls for establishing a long-term base on the Moon that could one day launch astronauts to Mars. I'm Brian Lynn.
I'm happy to welcome Brian Lynn back to the program to talk more about today's science report. Hi, Brian. Thanks for joining me.
Hi, Ashley. Glad to be back.
Today's report dealt with the recent launch of NASA's large SLS rocket and Orion space capsule, which is beginning a test mission to fly around the Moon. The word mission appears many times throughout the piece. What can you tell us about the use of this word?
Well, a very simple meaning of the word in this context, used as a noun, is an important trip that a spacecraft goes on. NASA describes its major space activities as missions, and Orion's trip is the latest. It is important to note that when mission is used this way, it usually describes an activity with a certain goal or result in mind. In this case, NASA has identified several goals it wants Orion to complete.
That's very helpful. What about some other meanings of the word?
It can also be used as a noun to describe an official group of people who are sent to a place to discover information about something. For example, government officials can go on a fact-finding or trade mission, and it can also mean a person's main goal or purpose in life. One could say Mother Teresa's mission in life was to help the poor.
Okay. Thanks, Brian, for joining me again on the program.
You're welcome. Thank you, Ashley.
From VOA Learning English, welcome to The Making of a Nation. I'm Steve Ember. The United States faced a deep national crisis in 1850. That crisis threatened to split the nation in two. It began over the issue of slavery in the new territories of California and New Mexico. Many Northerners wanted to ban slavery in the new territories, but Southern states believed the federal government did not have the right to decide where slavery could or could not go. President Zachary Taylor had no clear policy on the issue. He attempted to be neutral. He hoped the problem would solve itself, but he did not get his wish. In fact, the split between North and South grew wider. Many Southerners said the South should declare its independence from the rest of the country. Then, Senator Henry Clay of Kentucky stepped forward with a plan to save the Union. Clay had left the Senate in 1842, but returned in 1849. He was surprised to find how bitter the North and South had grown toward each other in his 7 years out of the Senate. Clay urged his friends in the border states, those between the Northern and Southern states, to work to build public support for the Union. He believed their support would help prevent the South from seceding. Clay also began to think about a compromise that might settle the differences between the two sections of the country. He once said, "I go for honorable compromise whenever it can be made. Life itself is but a compromise between death and life. The struggle continues through our whole existence until the great destroyer finally wins. All legislation, all government, all society is formed upon the principle of mutual concession, politeness, and courtesy. Upon these, everything is based." Clay was sure that a compromise between North and South was possible. Near the end of January in 1850, Clay completed work on his plan. Most parts of it already had been proposed as separate bills. Clay put them together in a way that both sides could accept. Clay proposed to the Senate that California join the Union as a slave-free state. He said, "Territorial governments should be formed in other parts of the Western territories, with no immediate decision on whether slavery would be permitted." Clay proposed the western border of Texas be changed to give New Mexico most of the land disputed by them. In exchange, he said, the national government should agree to pay the public debts that Texas had when it became a state. He proposed that no more slaves be sold in the District of Columbia for use outside the federal district. But he also said that slavery should not be ended in the district unless its citizens and those of Maryland approved. Clay said a better law was needed for the return of fugitive slaves to their owners. And he proposed that Congress declare it had no power to interfere with the slave trade between states. Senator Clay believed these 8 steps would satisfy the interests of both the North and the South. Senator Jefferson Davis of Mississippi declared that Clay's compromises did not offer anything of value to the South. He said the Southern states would accept nothing less than extending the Missouri Compromise line west to the Pacific Ocean. Extending the line meant that land to the south would be open to slavery. Clay answered that no power on earth could force him to vote to establish slavery where it did not exist. He said Americans had blamed Britain for forcing African slavery on the colonists. He said he would not have the future citizens of California and New Mexico blaming Henry Clay for slavery there. Clay said he did not want to debate, but wished that the senators would think carefully about his proposals. He said he hoped they would decide on them only after careful study. He asked them to see the proposals as a system of compromise, not as separate bills. Clay expected extremists on both sides to denounce the compromise, but he believed the more reasonable leaders of the North and South would accept it. 1 week after Clay first proposed the compromise, he rose in the Senate to speak in its defense. The Senate hall was crowded. People had come from as far away as Boston and New York to hear Clay speak. Some senators said there had not been such a crowd in the Capitol building since the day Clay said goodbye to the Senate 8 years earlier. Clay had to rest several times as he climbed the steps of the Capitol. He told a friend that he felt very tired and weak. His friend advised Clay to rest and make his speech later. "No," Clay said, "my country is in danger. If I can be the one to save it from that danger, then my health and life are not important." Senator Clay began his speech by talking of the serious crisis that faced the nation. He said that never before had he spoken to a group as troubled and worried as the one he spoke to now. Clay listed his 8 resolutions. Then he said, "No man on earth is more ready than I am to surrender anything which I have proposed and to accept in its place anything that is better. But I ask the honorable senators whether their duty will be done by simply limiting themselves to opposing any one or all of the resolutions I have offered. If my plan of peace and unity is not right, give us your plan. Let us see how all the questions that have arisen out of this unhappy subject of slavery can be better settled more fairly and justly than the plan I have offered. Present me with such a plan, and I will praise it with pleasure and accept it without the slightest feeling of regret." Clay said the major differences separating the country could be settled by facing facts. He said the first great fact was that laws were not necessary to keep slavery out of California and New Mexico. He said the people of California already had approved an anti-slavery state constitution. And he said the nature of land in New Mexico was such that slaves could not be used. Clay said there was justice in the borders he proposed for Texas. It would still be a very large state after losing the area it and New Mexico each claimed. And he said it was right for the United States to pay the debts of Texas because that state no longer could collect taxes on trade as an independent country. Clay said there was equal justice in his resolutions ending the slave trade in the District of Columbia and strengthening laws on the return of runaway slaves. He said the South, perhaps, would be helped more than the North by his proposals, but the North, he said, was richer and had more money and power. To the North, slavery was a matter of feeling. But to the South, Clay said, it was a hard social and economic fact. He said the North could look on in safety while the actions of some of its people were producing flames of bitterness throughout the southern states. Then Clay attacked the South's claim that it had the right to leave the Union. He said the Union of States was permanent, that the men who built the country did not do so only for themselves, but for all future Americans. Clay warned that if the South seceded, there would be war within 60 days. He said the slaves of the South would escape by the thousands to freedom in the North. Their owners would follow them and try to return them to slavery by force. These events, he said, would lead to war between the slaveholding and free states. He said this would not be a war of only 2 or 3 years. History had shown, he said, that such wars lasted many years and often destroyed both sides. Even if the South could secede without war, he said, it still would not get any of the things it demanded. Secession would not open the territories to slavery. It would not continue the slave trade in the District of Columbia. And it would not lead to the return of slaves who escaped to the North. So, said Clay, the South would not help itself by leaving the Union. His 2-day speech gave new hope to many that the Union could be saved. But extremists on both sides opposed his plan.
And that's our program for today. Join us again tomorrow to keep learning English through stories from around the world. I'm Ashley Thompson.
And I'm Dan Novak.